If you go to a oncologist, if you're diagnosed with cancer, you're basically going to be asking for the best intervention. And while understanding those risks, you're not likely to take the third best option. So similar with exercise, if we can again sort of promote general activity is great, but what is the best prescription for me?
Hi, Justin. It's my pleasure to have you on Evidence Strong Show. If you could briefly introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Justin Keogh. I'm currently at Bond University on the Gold Coast in Australia, where I've been for just over 13 years. And in that capacity, I'm an exercise sports science researcher and educator. Have been the Associate Dean of Research for our faculty for 2 years. And as of the 1st of January 2025, I'll be starting as the Head of Exercise and Sports Science as well. So next year is going to be a busy year.
So very lucky to catch you just before you will get too busy.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk to you about sarcopenia today. So let's start with the definition, what sarcopenia is.
So sarcopenia is a geriatric condition that was started to be examined within the research literature in the late 80s, early 90s, initially defined as the loss of muscle mass, which then had implications to muscle strength and physical performance. There's a host of different definitions and diagnostic criteria that have been examined historically. The newer definitions that we use in Australia are based on the revised European consensus definitions. And we now, within this definition, diagnostic criteria, utilize muscle strength as the primary characteristic, with muscle mass and physical performance as the secondary components of that diagnosis. But ultimately, all the different diagnoses and criteria are looking at some combination of muscle strength, muscle mass, and muscle performance, which is often assessed by things like walking speed or the ability to do sit to stands, those sort of very fundamental mobility sort of movements that many of us take for granted every day.
So seems like sarcopenia is a serious condition that impacts daily living. So who is the most susceptible to this condition?
Older adults in general. Obviously, we know that the age-related process, the aging process, does contribute to losses of strength, muscle mass, and function. And probably within our more sedentary lifestyles, that's potentially accelerated in certain groups. And within older people, perhaps the greatest risk factor is, again, age. So the older you get, the more likely sarcopenia will be identified. But in terms of other groups, people in hospitals or entry into hospitals are more at risk. For example, I found a systematic review recently by Wang in 2023 looking at hospitalized older people. And in that study, they only identified, I think it was 6 or 7 studies. On entry into the hospital, these older adults had prevalence rates between 14 to 55%. So in essence, 1 out of 7 to 1 out of 2 people. And then even those who did not have sarcopenia on entry, anything from 12 to 39% of them had sarcopenia before they left hospital.
Wow.
And the length of stay only between 6 to 10 days in those studies. So anyone going into hospital, and particularly someone experiencing a week or so of bed rest, that risk of either having it before you arrive in hospital or having it when you leave is relatively high.
That's shocking. Only a week.
Yeah, because unfortunately, exercise and even nutritional support in hospitals can be very challenging. Many people are in hospitals, they don't have appetite. The range of medications and surgical procedures they have means they lose appetite, or if they're having procedures, they can't eat for maybe many hours in the day. And then when they perhaps wake up, still not feeling great, and perhaps the typical meals that would be more nutritionally based wouldn't be available at those times. So, and some patients will have procedures that are rescheduled multiple times. So again, they have these multiple sort of fasting windows. And while some hospitals do offer some level, or they all try to offer some level of physical rehabilitation, the evidence and the amount of research in that space for what constitutes an optimal exercise prescription versus something that may actually accelerate the catabolic processes that they're already experiencing is poorly understood. And then the feasibility of offering such programs, even if we find some effective programs, is still going to be very complex to actually implement. Again, or some of those challenges these people face with their schedules can be not set in stone because of all the complexities and things that may happen within a hospital setting. So yeah, which then gets to potentially where possible, rehabilitation processes. So if you're scheduled to go in for, say, hip surgery in 2 months' time, what do you really need to be doing in terms of exercise and nutrition prior to that surgery to make sure you're not sarcopenic when you enter, to make sure that sort of your levels in reserve of muscle mass and strength are adequate so that when you leave hospital, you're still somewhat functional during the early stage of your rehab. So those are some guidelines that are starting, or recommendations certain papers are now starting to suggest. But again, if you've had a fall and you rushed to accident emergency, obviously there's no level of prehabilitation for that stay in hospital, unfortunately.
Yes. Could you maybe expand a little bit why the diet component is so important?
Yeah, obviously, even if we go back to athletic populations where we're looking to get, in essence, the flip side of sarcopenia, like getting stronger, greater physical performance, which again, for a weightlifter is their total in clean and jerk and snatch. For a sprinter, it's their time to 100 meters. A rugby player, everything they do on the field. In essence, we all know in those athletic populations that training is a big component, but unless you're fueling that training and recovery process with a range of macro and micronutrients, you don't get those gains that you potentially can get. And you also set yourself up for perhaps overtraining, illness, and even injury. So these concepts that we take for granted in athletic populations still apply to older adults. But again, it's still not as well understood, perhaps the interaction of all these nutrients. So a lot of hospital guidelines have some quite clear recommendations for calories per kilogram of body weight, calorie protein per kilograms of body weight. But I suppose it's the interaction of many nutrients that can support that recovery and anabolic processes. But unfortunately, some of these people might be in such catabolic states based on interactions between their age, their condition, the treatments that they're experiencing, that we, again, probably don't have that level of evidence of what constitutes that optimal nutritional total support.
Okay, so from what you said so far, sarcopenia is the biggest risk in older adults. So the older we get, the bigger the risk.
Yeah.
And especially anyone who is entering hospital with intention to have a procedure or some kind of treatment, especially if it will require bed rest. So
exactly,
these are people who should be worried, or we should be worried about as coaches.
Yeah,
and
exactly. So I think, again, where we can to set up perhaps and advocate for those pathways prior to entry to hospital for those planned procedures. And again, to look into, like, to some extent, like in the media where we look at almost the minimum effective dose of exercise. Again, I think that concept is really important in many regards, because often in the general population, we think of time as almost one of the biggest barriers to exercise. So if we can establish what is the minimum sort of volume or duration of exercise is required, that's great. And particularly in this hospital setting, if you have a physiotherapist or exercise physiologist, many of these patients are easily able to move to go to a hospital-based gym if it exists. What are the exercise options they can do in their bed? What are some things they could potentially do semi-supervised, or at least after some, I suppose, supervised sessions? Like, are there options for things like isometrics that could be performed a little bit more? Again, there's challenges there because we don't really know what forces people are producing or their compliance. Some of the alternative resistance training approaches that, again, we use in athletic populations, could some of those be applied in hospital situations? For example, something you've probably used in weightlifting, cluster sets to some extent. I mean, weightlifting is, in essence, do a few reps and then rest anyway. But these cluster sets are obviously much shorter than a weightlifter, where it might be, like in my experience in strongman as well, lift for a few seconds and then rest for five. Cluster sets are now starting to be used in a number of research studies, particularly for populations where their cardiovascular respiratory function is compromised, where doing eight typical reps that might take 30 seconds would just be too aerobically taxing. So they might do three or four repetitions, have a rest, and just repeat cycles of that. So that evidence, again, is quite interesting to start with. And again, just another example of where some principles we use with athletic populations is now starting to be applied in clinical populations as well.
Okay, so in terms of reducing the risk, you said diet and prehab. So preparing, if you know that the procedure is scheduled, there will be bed rest involved.
Mm-hmm.
Prehab can be used. In terms of specifics, so sarcopenia is to do with muscles, so resistance training is the way. Now, how to go about it, that may depend on many factors. Would you have some guidance what to take into account and how to think about structuring prehab program, or then later if it already happened and we have to rebuild, how to think it through? What are the options, factors we should take into account?
There's lots of things to consider and every case will be somewhat different. So that's where, again, a specialist like an exercise physiologist or a physiotherapist, those terms in my country would be the two key individual groups. But some general sort of recommendations from what's been done so far, again, is not dissimilar to general resistance training guidelines anyway. So 2 to 3 sessions per week, either total body each day or perhaps something like an upper body, lower body split. And if you did that, perhaps 4 sessions a week, so 2 upper body, 2 lower body. For an older person, a total duration of perhaps even 30 to 45 minutes would be ample if they haven't trained much before. So again, to minimize that sort of catabolic overtraining response. And you're just in essence doing movements that stimulate the greatest amount of muscle mass and simulate some of the movements within activities of daily living. So even if someone can't access a gym, like I've done, some of my colleagues of Jackson Fife wrote this awesome paper looking at 3 different options for exercise. Traditional resistance training, in essence, the high intensity approach, like the Mike Mensa, Dorian Yates bodybuilding style of super high intensity, very low volume and frequency, and then something called exercise snacking. So even for a person who doesn't want to visit the gym, can they incorporate things like more sit to stand throughout the day? If they're on the floor, can they do a couple of push-ups, knee push-ups, or even stand up and do wall push-ups? Ups or something like that. So those sort of movements, or TheraBands to do sort of rowing movements, perhaps load up a bit more the squatting patterns, those sort of activities. Or again, if you've got access to a gym, again, basically your squat type movement, your hinge type pattern to some extent, simulating a deadlift or Romanian deadlift, your upper body pushes like a bench press, shoulder press sort of movements, pulls like a pull down and a row, that sort of general, almost what we'd consider a standard resistance training beginners program would be the basis of that sort of program. So doesn't have to be a huge number of sets and reps, so perhaps 2 sets of each of those exercises. And while the muscle mass gains won't be huge in that 1 to 2 months prehab, it will definitely get them to a state where they're familiar with the movements. The delayed onset muscle soreness, they'll have worked through that stage. They'll have less anxiety about performing those movements, particularly post-surgery, because obviously if I was an older person who's never trained and I've had surgery, I'd be like going, oh, should I be lifting? Should I be straining? And even if the muscle mass gains are quite small, which they will typically be in the age group over 8 weeks, and even younger adults, we don't just put on 5 kilos of muscle in 8 weeks anyway. When I was younger, the strength and the performance gains can still be quite profound in those 8 weeks.
Awesome.
Which then gives them that additional threshold where if they lose some stuff during their bed rest, they're still above that level of sort of disability that certain people will go lower than post hospital time.
Right. I think we should also maybe talk about what are the consequences of sarcopenia. So why do we even care?
Yeah, sarcopenia has it's related to so many, I suppose, age-related either symptoms or conditions. So if we look at muscle in itself, muscle is a large tissue within the body. It plays a really important role in a host of areas. It helps control blood sugar levels. So again, with reduced levels of muscle mass, your risk of type 2 diabetes and other cardiometabolic diseases increases. And we know that that condition is quite prevalent in middle to older age. And once you get to a certain point of low muscle mass and potentially increased body fat, it's a condition called sarcopenic obesity, which again is really challenging to offset, because with reduced muscle and increased fat, trying to gain muscle to offset the sarcopenia may actually increase body fat stores a little bit initially, because you want to be in that calorie surplus. So it's quite a difficult condition to manage, and it's becoming more prevalent. So that sort of level, muscle is obviously highly related to strength and function. And that's where more of my research focuses on than the sort of the physiology and the cardiometabolic health. There's some great researchers doing awesome work in that. So in that area that I focus on, it's more so about just there's a certain level of muscle that we require to maintain muscle strength. And that strength is integral to us doing activities that we've taken for granted through the early stages of our life, like getting out of a chair. Some of the research we've done in aged care facilities, the individuals in our training studies and our assessment studies almost never can do a sit to stand with their hands on their chest. So that's the way we assess the sit to stand maneuver, with the hands on the chest. So it's just leg strength only. And most older adults in residential aged care, or what's called nursing homes in other countries, are unable to do that. So it's like a load. So an athletic population, it's like doing a one rep max squat with a weight just a little bit beyond your capacity. So without using their arms to push off the chair, which makes it like a squat dip combination, they can't get out of a chair. And if you consider what your life would be in terms of not being able to get out of the chair that you're currently sitting in today, Alex, there's a lot of things you're not doing without assistance. So increasing their strength in that sit to stand maneuver then enables them to stand more often on their own. If we then can improve their walking speed, which again, we've done in residential aged care across multiple studies, and quite profound increases in walking speed that might be close to 15 to 20% of their baseline, that then enables them, say in an aged care facility, to go, my best friend, and Pam, she's five rooms down the corridor. I can now get out of my chair and walk and visit her without feeling exhausted. So little things like that can make quite a profound change in some of these older people's lives. And if more community dwelling older people can maintain that sort of level of function, less of them are likely to go into residential aged care, because most clients going into aged care would be one of a combination of three factors: physical decline, in essence, sarcopenia, cognitive decline, so some level of dementia or Alzheimer's, and thirdly, perhaps complex medical conditions, which again requires a little bit more monitoring from nursing and medical staff. So those would be some of the big adverse events, and then associated things like early mortality, additional comorbidities, increased healthcare costs, and trips to healthcare and medical professionals. So again, I think the last thing most people want to do in their retirement is continually be going to medical appointments and being in and out of hospital, and not being able to do things like holidays, play with their grandkids or great grandkids, things of that nature.
Muscle mass is one aspect, but there is obvious social component that comes to it that shouldn't be underestimated. Is that
That's right? Definitely true. And perhaps most of our studies, we don't focus enough on those psychosocial benefits. We're much more interested, and I'll unpack the bone mass as well. I forgot to talk about bone mass. We often focus on, again, bone or muscle mass in terms of DEXA or other imaging techniques. We'll look at some measures of strength, and then perhaps some measures of sit to stand or walking speed as our functional test. But we forget that ultimately the reason we're trying to help them regain those factors is to be physically mobile, to be engaged in a group of people. And when we try to encourage older people to do more of this form of exercise, be it in aged care or back in the community, it's those things that actually sell the program in terms of initiating the program and long-term retention. So when I was in New Zealand, I spent almost 10 years at Auckland University of Technology, and they developed a program called Never Too Old. It's still running now. So I moved to New Zealand in 2002. I think it was developed in 2001 as a pilot. It's now still available in something like 20 locations across the northern island of New Zealand. And the biggest thing this program is about function and independence. And they do an amazing job of just asking people why they've joined or why they're thinking of joining. What are the things that they want to make sure they retain as they age? Or perhaps what are some of the things that they've stopped doing because of some medical or physical challenge? And then the exercise prescription after the initial sort of 8-week familiarization, where they're just in essence getting used to the gym, lighter loads, simple machine-based exercises predominantly initially to get them comfortable, get through the delayed onset muscle soreness. After that point, they're progressively challenging them. The exercise prescription is adapted in ways where they'll try to, in essence, assist them with the activities that are most meaningful to them. So if it's wanting to get back into playing some sport, and these days it might be pickleball, might be a big example, or lawn bowls or golf, what are some of the challenges they might face in that? Is it maintaining their yard or their house in terms of housework chores? Is it playing with the grandkids? Is it hiking on the beach or in the hills? Or just even simply being able to go shopping and crossing a road that's four lanes across, which means, like, if the traffic lights are only, if that walking sign is only available for a certain number of seconds, what's the average speed they need to be able to walk at to get across there safely? Just little things like that. So they do a great job of asking those sort of questions and challenging those individuals. So some of these long-term individuals in that program have some amazing videos and standing on BOSU balls, throwing medicine balls at mini tramps, catching them, doing walking lunges on those big blue physio pads. So again, most students in my classes, if I ask them to do that, no one really jumps up to show off, particularly when I've showed the video of a 70-year-old lady doing these exercises. It's just too risky for them not to be able to do it in front of their peers. So, and again, they movements such as lunges, squat, deadlift variations, rotational movements, medicine balls, a host of those things are incorporated routinely in their sort of programs, which again aren't too different to our athletic prescription progression approaches in younger athletic pops. But instead of, again, be it a rugby game or a netball game as the outcome, it's these activities of daily living that we're trying to improve their function so they can, in essence, maximize the productive and healthy and engaging years of their life that they can, like, again, when I retire, I don't want those years of life to be spent in hospitals and medical appointments. I want to be out there doing stuff that, to some extent, I haven't had time to do because I've been too busy working.
True, true. I think when we think in general about retirement, we think holidays, not hospitals. So it would be good if that could stay that way as we go through life.
That's a great point. That might be a cool ratio to actually look at the hospital versus holiday time as maybe, not sure if I'm being facetious here, but almost an outcome of choice in terms of changing your life quite radically.
Yeah. That's for me, that would be the measure of quality of my retirement for sure.
Yeah.
Of one versus the other. Okay, let's go back a little bit to the biological underpinnings, and I want to use your expertise while I have you. So would you be able to say how much of muscle or bone density is not enough? Is there a number? This is how much you have to have, otherwise you're in trouble, or how do you measure?
Right,
because you said strength is the main diagnostic criterion, but...
Yeah, that's a great question and something that is still being debated in multiple ways. So if we go back to the European Working Group, the two strength tests that we use are the hand grip strength. So for men, it's 27 kilograms is that threshold. So anyone less than 27 kilos is considered at risk of sarcopenia. And for women, that's 16 kilograms. So if we're talking for people like pounds, that's about 35 pounds for women and somewhere just under 60 pounds for men. The other one is the sit to stand or the chair stand, if you want to call it that. So irrespective of sex, it's 15 seconds for 5 sit to stands. So
we need to know exactly how the test look like. The patient or the person is sitting on the chair, then they have to stand up without using hands.
Yeah, hands on their chest, like in a cross, and the hips have to touch the chair. And when you complete the stand, you need to be standing completely vertical like a flagpole. So in essence, similar again to powerlifting, like that sort of almost thighs parallel to a fully standing upright position. So either of those tests is that sort of initial assessment. Then if that test, if they don't pass those thresholds, then the measures of muscle mass, they use something called appendicular skeletal muscle. So it's basically the muscle in the arms and legs. 20 kilograms, which is around 45 pounds for men, and 15 kilograms, which is around 34 pounds for women, are those thresholds. So anything underneath that. But we also need to be aware that for a taller individual, that might not be sufficient. So they then normalize by height squared. So again, this gets a bit complex to the average person and even some clinicians. But there still are debates, I suppose, for different ethnic groups that are potentially quite different in body sort of size and shape. So as an example, I suppose the 10 years I spent in New Zealand, I became much more familiar with Maori and Pacific Islanders, who traditionally are much stockier individuals. So those numbers would foreseeably have to probably be a bit higher for them, but I don't know any research that's investigated that. Whereas there's also lots of people from Southeast Asia countries who are much less stocky. So what those numbers would be, as an example, for those populations, there are discussions about that. And hence there is a Asian sarcopenic definition as well. I'm not as familiar with the exact cutoffs there. So different countries or continents have developed some of their own sort of diagnostic cutoff points.
Do we have any cutoff points for bone density? And
yeah, typically we haven't focused on that in the sarcopenic research and the group that I'm a part of. And while I did mention sarcopenic obesity before, there's also been individuals that have proposed osteosarcopenia. So if we consider people with low muscle mass, the premise of this is muscles pull on bone, and those who are physically active and get that impact from impact loading are also likely to have muscle. So the premise is that if you've got low muscle mass and strength, you're also likely to have low bone mass. So again, we do see individuals who are diagnosed with sarcopenia also typically have higher rates of osteoporosis as well. So there's some great research in Australia. Belinda Beck's group at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia, have done some awesome work, the LiftMall trials, which are in essence adaptations of powerlifting, the squat, the deadlift. They've replaced the bench press with the overhead press. They'll do partial range of motion movements initially, and they supplement that with impact loading as well. So those series of studies, I think over the last 10 to 15 years, have demonstrated a range of profound benefits of bone characteristics. So Belinda Beck's group have found some amazing results in terms of bone mineral density, in that many studies in older populations don't show significant benefits for bone mineral density of resistance training. So supplementing resistance training for the impact loading seems to do so. But even resistance training on its own, while it won't necessarily make significant improvements in bone mass or other bone characteristics, seems to reduce the age-related loss. So when we compare them to people who are less active, that age-related decline is much further reduced. So including resistance of total body movements with that impact loading is beneficial. But again, the potential risks of both those forms of exercise for people with osteoporosis is obviously there. So again, these are forms of exercise that exercise physiologists and physiotherapists will be supervising. And in Australia, this program is available, I think internationally as well, ONERO. I think it's spelled O-N-E-R-O. So again, physios or exercise physiologists can, in essence, apply to the, as like a franchisee owner, I think in essence it would be sort of described as, where they can deliver that sort of program in their own location, get ongoing support and additional research refinements that the researchers are doing. I'm sure there's a financial cost to that, but again, that would be what we would probably say at the moment is the best evidence-based level of exercise prescription for older people with osteoporosis or osteopenia that will also, in essence, virtually eliminate their risk of sarcopenia and sarcopenic-related outcomes. So osteoporosis and sarcopenia, I think if we were to examine those two things concurrently, we'd find a relatively high proportion of those diagnosed with one condition will either have the other condition or at least be quite at risk for that second condition as well. Because again, in strength athletes, as examples, we know those strong muscles are also associated with strong bones. You can't lift twice your body weight squats or put weights overhead in the clean and jerk unless those muscles and bones are both strong and dense.
I think it's pretty clear that resistance exercise, some form of impact training, whatever is lacking in the person you have in front of you, that would be the way to go, and progressing it slowly, possibly with the help of physiotherapist or exercise physiologist if the case is complicated or severe in the presentation. Anything else? Anything I'm missing?
I think those are some of the key things, because I think, again, public health messages are good. Walking is a great activity for many people. Unfortunately, a percentage of older people get to the point where they are fearful of falls, and walking is an activity where they're more at risk of falls, particularly on some environmental conditions. So like when I lived in New Zealand, in Auckland, through the winter, the colder periods, daylight would be maybe 7 o'clock in the morning to 4 or 4:30 in the afternoon. Many of the footpaths could be a bit slippery. It would always be raining. So there's many environmental potential dangers of walking outside. And while walking is good, it doesn't really stimulate those muscle and bone adaptations to the same extent that resistance and impact training does. So it's definitely better than nothing. Doing some of that body weight or TheraBand stuff at home and the exercise snacking approach is better again. But for the optimal outcome, particularly for those who might be diagnosed with osteoporosis and sarcopenia, a gym-based program supervised by a physiologist or physiotherapist utilizing this evidence base we have is the best prescription. And if we think of other examples, if you go to a oncologist, if you're diagnosed with cancer, you're basically going to be asking for the best intervention. And while understanding those risks, you're not likely to take the third best option. So similar with exercise, if we can again sort of promote general activity is great, but what is the best prescription for me? And if medical practitioners are maybe better informed of some of these things, and some of the research we've done was looking at both consumers and clinicians' understanding of sarcopenia in Australasia, and that's still something we need to work a lot more on. David Scott and Robin Daly from Melbourne are doing some initial work with GPs in that space at the moment. So there should be some really good research findings coming out in 2025, where they're actually looking at these algorithms for sarcopenia diagnoses and trying to educate more Australian GPs on the importance of sarcopenia screening and then what to do if individuals are identified as sarcopenic. What is that nutritional, exercise, and to some level psychological support in that pharmacological interventions currently don't appear to have sufficient evidence as an intervention at this point of time. In this case, GPs need to refer to non-pharmacological interventions to get that outcome, with exercise and diet, those two key components.
Awesome. One more factor, we covered cutoff points for bone density kind of, and for muscle. Are there any certain age? We know that after this age, we should be really worried and checking for sarcopenia or osteoporosis.
Yeah, so probably somewhere again around 65, these things become much more prevalent. But even in a study that came out recently, depending on the actual, there's a study with 1,500 individuals in the Do Health study, depending on the definition diagnostic criteria, they in the 65-year-old community dwelling quite healthy individuals, the prevalence was anything between about 1% up to about 18%, depending on the definition diagnostic criteria. So ultimately, even within that, those who weren't sarcopenic are probably at risk of sarcopenia anyway, getting closer to those thresholds, but it's still a little bit unclear, like even in these studies, how representative of different populations are these studies, and one study in one country, how is that likely to apply to another country, and potentially even seasonal effects. If it's a warmer location, would some of these measures be a little bit different than in winter? We're not quite sure on that.
Okay, let's try to wrap up. So let's imagine we have an older person coming to the gym. They have been diagnosed with sarcopenia. They want to do something about it. Now, from the perspective of the coach, strength and conditioning coach or CrossFit coach or weightlifting coach, what the coaches should be aware of, what they should know?
I suppose if they are diagnosed with sarcopenia, they're also likely to be at least at risk of osteoporosis. So we do need to be a little bit careful with the prescription. We do need to be careful, particularly if we're going to try to get more older people in the gym, is the environment safe? Are there trip hazards? The trip is the most common fall in older adults. And when you fall forward, you're likely to put your hand out to catch you. And the wrist fracture or the clavicle fractures are often very common there. And that's not a good sort of fracture to experience. So simple things like that, the exercise prescription, again, potentially looking at machines to start with or body weight versions that aren't overly complex. And again, there might need to be ways to make the movements easier. So can they maybe hold on or push with their arms to different squat movement patterns? Can they have TheraBands to act as assistance rather than resistance? Push-up patterns maybe on walls with their hands or benches. So some relatively simple general fundamental movements to begin with. And then depending on the flavor of the gym, be it CrossFit, be it standard gym, weightlifting, introducing some of those movements or variations of those movements that they can do safely. And that'll probably just get down to the ingenuity of the coach and getting an understanding of what are these clients coming through. But yeah, like having a weightlifting class, like in essence, variations of the snatch or clean and jerks for older people, how functional would those people be after 6 months of such training? That would be cool. The impacts, like I love the split jerk, just that sound with the front foot hitting the ground when you drive that front leg forward. So again, the forces going through, those impact forces going through the front leg must be huge. Like, it would be interesting to see what some of the sort of bone adaptations in elite weightlifters are on that front leg that they plant all the time. And then if you think more of the crossfitting nature, what are some of the bodyweight gymnastic sort of variations that they coach as well? How could they sort of be incorporated? And there's some amazing videos of, again, not a typical 80 or 90 year old individuals doing CrossFit and weightlifting activities and gymnastics as well. So all those sort of things could easily be something that individuals that run such gyms can maybe start to think of. Do I want to, in essence, target this demographic as a group I really want to work with? And if so, how do I perhaps work with specialists, GPs, and some physiotherapists or exercise physiologists in that space, and then develop sort of a model exercise prescription that will enable those safe progressions, but then also think of what those psychosocial requirements that these people might want, the benefits that they'll get, and how you can, in essence, develop some type of community where these people come in. And just like a regular weightlifting or CrossFit type gym or strongman gym, in my experience, how all these people become great friends moving into the future. And even some strongman gyms, like one on the Gold Coast, I'll give a quick plug, Coco's, where I've done some training and competed at. They have grandparents training there. They have teenagers training there. And I believe there are at least some families with two or even three generations training there as well. So men and women of different body sizes, different sporting backgrounds, some who haven't even been sort of sporty before, now call that place home.
That's awesome. I think that's a good place to finish. Just two questions to wrap up. What is your favorite lift?
When I did strongman, it would probably have to be the truck pull and the farmer's walk. They were, I think, definitely my favorite events. It was very difficult to train for the truck pull because it's hard to get trucks. And particularly if you've got a group of individuals of different sizes and experiences, difficult to get a truck that's the appropriate load for each individual. So different sled pull variations were useful there. Farmer's walks were easily loadable. There's so many farmer's walk handles available these days. So they were my two favorite events, maybe also because they're my two best events as well. But yeah, pulling a truck in particular, like I competed in powerlifting before that. And obviously your background in weightlifting, it's cool going to those events, but watching someone pull a massive truck or bus 25 meters using your legs and the thick sort of gymnast type rope with a pull-up style movement, seeing that move pretty fast is pretty spectacular. And yeah, great having crowds there cheer you on as well.
Awesome. Okay, where people can find you if they want to follow up, have a question, or they just want simply see what you're up to in your research?
Yeah, so research side of things, if they search for me, my name comes up pretty quickly. But if you just type in Justin Keogh, Bond University, my profile come up there. In research, you can also find that same research on ResearchGate, where you can get many of those publications free PDFs. I also have some Twitter and LinkedIn accounts, and Twitter is Dr. Strength for Life, where the four is the actual number. So Dr. Strength, number four, Life. It's my Twitter profile where I do try to share, and a little bit on LinkedIn, some of the research we do or other research I think is interesting in athletic as well as older populations.
Excellent. Thank you, Justin. It was a pleasure.
All right. Thanks very much, Alex. Pleasure was all mine as well. Thanks.